It's Tuesday, May 31st, 2016. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The value of human life over against the life of animals was drawn to our national attention over the weekend when at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden, a four-year-old boy slipped under an enclosure and into a moat inside the gorilla exhibit and into the hands of a 17-year-old male gorilla. As the events unfolded on Saturday in Cincinnati, zoo officials made the decision that they had to kill the gorilla in order to save the boy. And that set off a cultural conversation that reveals to us a very great deal of our modern confusion. A modern confusion that we need to note that is not only a matter of concern, but of deadly significance, because we're talking about the dignity and sanctity of human life. In this case, you have an almost perfect storm of unique circumstances. You have a four-year-old boy who had escaped his mother and had fallen into the enclosure of Western lowland gorillas, a very endangered species. And then you had two females that were lured out of the enclosure by zoo officials, a dangerous animals response team that knew immediately what to do first. But then the male gorilla in the enclosure, a 17-year-old named Harambe, grabbed the child, at first appearing, according to onlookers, to try to protect the child, but then turned violent, dragging the child through the moat and posing what zoo officials recognized was an immediate danger. Thus, the dangerous animals response team and the zoo's leadership had to make a very quick decision. You're talking about a 450-pound gorilla that is very aggressive and extremely powerful. Several zoo officials said the animal is so powerful that it could tear apart a grown man almost within seconds. When it came to a four-year-old boy, the danger was immediately clear, and the images of the gorilla dragging the child through the moat make that abundantly clear. Zoo officials did what they felt they had to do, and they ordered a marksman to shoot the gorilla, killing him and thus saving the life of the boy. There was an immediate outcry coming from those who said that some other avenue should have been chosen. But zoo officials quickly determined that tranquilizing the animal was not an option because it could take up to 30 minutes to take effect. And furthermore, there was a sign of the immediate danger of the child growing in such a manner that tranquilization would not be a realistic way to save the child. Thus, the death of the animal was ordered by zoo officials. And for the zoo's officials, who clearly love and care for the animals under their supervision, it was a heartbreaking but a very quick decision. Responding for the zoo to the press was Zoo Director Thane Maynard, who said, quote, "We are heartbroken about losing Harambe, but a child's life was in danger and a quick decision had to be made by our dangerous animal response team," end quote. A news story like this is almost certain to create instantaneous headlines and to reverberate across the world, and that's exactly what happened. Here you have not only an animal, but an endangered species, and the endangered species specimen was in a zoo. And that is controversial on the part of many animal rights activists who do not believe that zoos have any continuing purpose. Some go so far as to argue that it is a form of imprisonment, that it is an unethical limitation upon these animals, taking them out of their natural habitat. When it comes to Western lowland gorillas, who everyone admits to be a very endangered species, the controversy just gets ratcheted even higher. But those who are in favor of the zoos come back and make the argument that the zoos themselves will be largely responsible for saving these species. It had been hoped, as a matter of fact, that Harambe would be a major factor in the breeding program to save the species. But there was also the kind of response that is now very sadly predictable, and that is the response of those who seem to be very, very confused, indeed horrifyingly confused, about the distinction between animal and human life. Some responded in a more measured way. Groups such as the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals assaulted the very idea of zoos and pointed to some at least partially common sense solutions, such as the fact that if zoos are going to have these exhibits, they ought to have better protections, including an inner buffer between where the public would be and the moat where the animals have access. That's the kind of reasonable response that can come even when there's a disagreement about the moral nature of zoos themselves. But the greater concern comes with the headline that appeared yesterday at the Washington Post, an article by Peter Holly with the headline, quote, "Shooting an endangered animal is worse than murder." Subtext, "Grief over gorilla's death turns to outrage." As Holly reports, the killing of an endangered gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo to rescue a boy who fell into a dangerous embankment unleashed an outpouring of grief over the holiday weekend. Within hours, he writes, that grief had turned to fury as critics questioned the zoo's decision to kill the endangered 17-year-old gorilla and called for the boy's parents to be punished for not adequately supervising their child. The Washington Post draws attention to a Facebook phenomenon, a page called Justice for Harambe. According to the Post, as of yesterday midday, it had received more than 41,000 likes within just hours of its creation. What's really notable is the fact that the Washington Post has written the story. This takes it out of the realm of mere social media and into a very formal national conversation. The Facebook page described the shooting of Harambe as a murder. The page's description, says the reporter, is that it was created to, quote, raise awareness of Harambe's murder, end quote. Included in that webpage statement is a statement made by a man identified as Per Sørensen from Denmark. He made this statement, quote, shooting an endangered animal is worse than murder, end quote. Thus the headline in the Washington Post story. Now, it would be insignificant in one sense if that kind of statement were to be made out there somewhere in social media, unattached to any major cultural conversation. You would expect ridiculous things to be said by people who are given to saying ridiculous things. But what makes this really important and what caught the attention of the Washington Post is that the statement that was made by this man in Denmark appears to have significant traction in the larger culture, and not just where you might expect it. The Hollywood Reporter gives us the indication that almost immediately as the headlines emerged, Hollywood celebrities lined up to express their own outrage over the shooting death of the gorilla as an endangered species. Keep in mind that just last week we talked about the New York Times story indicating that elephants are the new end cause for Hollywood celebrities. You can probably add Harambe now to that list. But what is really interesting and distressing in terms of the Washington Post story is the argument that is made that the shooting of Harambe, a Western lowland gorilla, admittedly an endangered species, is rightly defined as murder. And then to have the statement made by someone else on that very same page indicating, let me repeat the words again, shocking as they are, quote, shooting an endangered animal is worse than murder. Here you have a double confusion. In the first place, although the killing of an animal can certainly be wrong, it is not murder. Murder is reserved for the killing of a human being. More on that in just a moment. The second confusion has to do with the argument that shooting an endangered animal is actually worse than murder. And here you have the fact that there is such a deadly confusion over human dignity and the sanctity of human life that you have the argument being made that a boy should have been sacrificed to a gorilla. This is where Christians must be rescued from the larger cultural confusion by the clarity of biblical theology. We turn to the Christian worldview established in Scripture to be reminded that animals are a part of God's creation and a part of the goodness of God's creation. Even as the biblical worldview begins with those very words, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, we come to understand that He filled the earth with those things that bring Him glory, and that includes animals in all of their variety and in all of their wonder. But the biblical worldview establishes a very clear distinction between all of the animal kingdom and human beings, the only beings made in God's image. And of human beings, there is not only a special testimony in Scripture, but a special category, the category of the image bearer of God. This is made very clear in the opening two chapters of the book of Genesis. It is also made abundantly clear in chapters 5 and chapters 9. In chapter 9, we are told that murder is a particular sin to be punishable by death precisely because the one who takes an innocent human life is destroying an image bearer of God. There a distinction is made precisely between the killing of human beings and the killing of an animal. The biblical worldview tells us that it is our Christian responsibility to honor the glory of God in creation, and thus never to treat any part of God's creation, the animal kingdom included, with anything less than the respect that is its due. But the Scripture also says that the human relationship to animals is one of dominion and one of stewardship. This is made very clear in Genesis 1:28, and it is affirmed throughout Scripture. As a matter of fact, the distinction in the value between animal life and human life was made by Jesus Himself, as we read in Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 9. We are told that Jesus went from there and entered their synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. The Pharisees, trying to entrap Jesus, ask him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" so that they might accuse him. In verse 11 we read, "He said to them, 'Which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out?'" And then Jesus made this emphatic statement that in most translations is even concluded with an exclamation point. Jesus said in Matthew 12, verse 12, "Of how much more value is a man than a sheep?" So the biblical worldview from beginning to end tells us of a categorical distinction between the animal kingdom and the human creature, the human creature alone made in the image of God. But we also need to note that the biblical worldview reminds us in Genesis chapter 3 and also beyond that sin has had its effect in the animal kingdom as mankind now faces the reality of violence and predation, not only towards animals, but from animals. And what you saw in the video that has now gone viral of that gorilla dragging that little 4-year-old boy through that moat as if he was a rag doll, what you have there is a sign of the threat of the animal kingdom, a threat that is sometimes directly posed not just to another species, but to the image bearer. That explains the decision that was made by the officials at the Cincinnati Zoo. Thane Maynard, the head of the zoo, speaking to the press, got it exactly right when he made very clear that for the zoo, it was really an easy, though heartbreaking decision, a decision to save the life of a boy, even if that meant taking the life of a Western lowland gorilla, an animal highly prized and much respected by the very zookeepers who had to make this difficult decision. No, it actually wasn't a difficult decision, and we need to note that the keeper of the zoo didn't describe it as a difficult decision. He instead described it as a clear decision, but he used the word heartbreaking. Now, as you consider that controversy and what it already has revealed about the confusion about human dignity and the status of human life, consider the fact that the current edition of The New Yorker, the magazine that comes out in its newsstands just this week, has a story by Joshua Rothman asking the question, "What is it like to be an animal?" And it's an article that is clearly intended to be taken seriously by serious people, the kind of serious people amongst the intellectual elites who are known to be the readers of The New Yorker. As we're thinking about postmodern confusion when it comes to human dignity, it's hard to know how to exemplify it more readily than the opening sentence in this article. Quote, "Thomas Thwaites first considered becoming an animal on a spring day in 2013. He was walking Noggin, his niece's Irish terrier, along the Thames when he found himself taking stock of his life." Now, as the story goes on, it turns out that this man, Thomas Thwaites, a rather failed artist, at least economically speaking, was determining how he was going to lead the rest of his life, and he found himself, in some sense, feeling jealous of Noggin, that is, the Irish terrier. He decided that he would be better off as an animal, and he decided he would try to become one. Rothman writes, quote, "He thought it must be wonderful to live in Noggin's eternal present, to smell the grass, the wind, and the water without worrying about the future, the past, the meaning of life, or the inevitability of death. How much simpler to be an animal!" Exclamation point, end quote. Now, the story goes on, and it is intended to be taken very seriously. It's not only about Thomas Thwaites, but about another man who also decided that they would become animals. And they're making the argument seriously, seriously enough to gain this major article in The New Yorker. After consulting with a shaman in order to determine how he might spiritually cross the species barrier, the story tells us that he eventually decided he would become a goat. In order to do that, he had to learn the goat mind. Quote, "To understand it, he began spending time at Buttercup Sanctuary for Goats, a pastoral facility in Kent, that is, in Britain. From a goat behavior expert named Alan McGilliatt, Thwaites learned that goats are relatively relaxed and resilient creatures who are slaves to hierarchy, good and bad news, we are told, for his prospective life as a goat. He actually found someone that made prosthetic limbs in order to make him limbs so that he could, at least by his own claim, approximate the gait of a goat and its movements. He tried to eat like a goat, something that he achieved with what we could only describe as limited success, and then he studied the philosopher Martin Heidegger, who argued about selfhood and how it is defined. This is how Rothman describes that encounter. Quote, "Reading Heidegger convinced Thwaites that to inhabit the mental life of a goat, he would need to relate to his surroundings in a goat-like way." Then he quotes Thwaites, quote, "I need to change my context," he resolved, "to the extent that somehow I look at a chair and don't automatically associate it with sitting." He would, said Rothman, have achieved goathood when he could see a word without reading it, or more important, quote, look at another goat and think of it as another person like me. At this point, we simply have to note that it is not ever going to be possible for this man to, quote, achieve goathood, end quote. It is categorically impossible. And it's categorically impossible precisely because this man, whether he recognizes it or not, is a human being made in the image of God. To make the matter rather bluntly, it is not a goat that is trying to invent such nonsense about how to achieve humanhood. Here you have an apparently confused and self-delusional human being who imagines that he might be able to achieve goathood. The other man in the article is Charles Foster. He has been at one point a lecturer in medical ethics at the University of Oxford. Now he has decided that he will be a badger that lives in the woods. Quote, for 6 weeks, Foster lived as a badger in the woods. He drug an underground badger lair or set, sleeping there during the night and venturing out on all fours at night. Badgers eat earthworms. Quote, when you put a worm in your mouth, he reports, it senses the heat as something sinister, searching for gaps between your teeth until you bite down and taste slime in the land. But he goes on to say, quote, there's a lot you can't see at badger level, 6 inches above the ground or under it, and so badgers rely on other senses, it is believed, for example, that they can hear the bristles of an earthworm plowing the dirt, end quote. Now, to state the matter bluntly, whether or not badgers can do that, human beings can't, because we weren't made to live 6 inches off the ground listening for earthworms, which we would eat. The New Yorker article tells us that Foster actually involved his own 8-year-old son, Tom, in this experiment, trying to get him also to live like a badger. But as it turns out, one of their main goals was to meet other badgers who would see them as badgers, but that didn't happen. Quote, in 6 weeks, however, they never met any badgers. They heard them and tried to approach them, but to no avail, end quote. Now, at this point, we simply have to observe that in all likelihood, the badgers actually understood that these were not badgers. They had not achieved badgerhood, and they never would. Rothman tells us, quote, unnerved, Foster fled back to civilization, bringing with him this image of the ultimate mystery and inaccessibility of badger life, end quote. But just when you think that things surely can't get even more confused and even more dangerous, Rothman tells us about some intellectuals who are now arguing that we as human beings aren't even smart enough to know how smart animals are. He cites primatologist Franz de Waal, who says, quote, even the term non-human grates on me, since it lumps millions of species together by an absence, as if they were missing something, end quote. Rothman writes, instead of comparing animals to ourselves, he argues, we should recognize that every animal is an animal in its own way, end quote. And by that, de Waal clearly intends to include human beings as just another animal. But it is extremely significant that here you have de Waal arguing that he bristles against the categories of human and non-human because the use of that term non-human seems to insinuate that those non-human creatures are missing something the human beings possess. That's exactly the point, isn't it? That is exactly what the biblical worldview affirms, that those non-human creatures are missing something. They are not made in the image of God. Human beings, every single human being is. The point made by this article in the New Yorker is that even though these two men are clearly on shaky grounds in terms of self-identity and, of course, their knowledge of themselves as human beings, the point is that the New Yorker wants us to see that this is a rather important conversation and one that includes not only these two men, one who tried to be a goat and the other to try to be a badger, but also informed and very influential academics such as Francis de Waal. This mass and deadly confusion now comes, disguised sometimes, with academic respectability. But there's something very telling in how Rothman concludes his article. Even though he has given more credit to this nonsense than it deserves, and that itself is noteworthy, he does seem to see through the entire experiment. He writes in the last paragraph of the article, quote, there is an irony to these books, that is the books by these two men. The more Thwaites and Foster try to change into animals, the more fully they become Thwaites and Foster. That is certainly true, and as you consider this, just remember the fact that both of these men have now written books. Let's just note, goats and badgers don't write books, nor do they read them. The title of Joshua Rothman's article in the New Yorker is The Metamorphosis, but that's the real irony, isn't it? There was no metamorphosis. Finally, the issues of human identity and human dignity have been big in the past week. Just in recent days, the New York Times ran an article, quote, "Not close to human, artificial intelligence still raises concern." John Markoff writes about a meeting convened last week by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, a meeting that brought together legal specialists, technologists, and scientists to explore questions, quote, "about autonomous systems that would increasingly make decisions about human input in areas like warfare, transportation, and health," end quote. The really interesting part of the article comes with the warnings that artificial intelligence might be recognized as a threat to human dignity. One of the claims behind so much of the AI movement is that eventually machines are going to think even more consciously than human beings and will exceed the consciousness and intelligence of the human species. Ed Felton, a computer scientist who is Deputy Chief Technology Officer for the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, said, quote, "The AI community, that's artificial intelligence, keeps climbing one mountain after another, and as it gets to the top of each mountain, it sees ahead still more mountains," end quote. The bottom line of the article, even though artificial intelligence is real and is growing by leaps and bounds, undergirding it is a human intelligence. Artificial intelligence, it turns out, really isn't artificial in terms of being separated from human intelligence. That was made clear by Paul Allen, who said that much of the confusion here, by the way, he is the co-founder of Microsoft, he says that much of the confusion is the way that artificial intelligence is presented in Hollywood. He also made the argument that much of the media conversation about artificial intelligence misses the obvious. And this obvious fact is something to which we have been pointing time and again on The Briefing. And that is that even though there are claims about artificial intelligence being truly artificial, the fact is there are human brains that are behind whatever is now called artificial intelligence. As Allen warned, attention-getting feats like Google's AlphaGo program, which, as the Times said, defeated a human champion in the board game Go, it had, quote, "plenty of humans behind the machine doing the work," end quote. All these stories taken together just from recent days remind us that human dignity is very much at stake, and we need to know it is always at stake. Our only rescue from this kind of very dangerous confusion is the biblical worldview that is given to us in Scripture. Once that worldview disappears and human dignity is grounded in something other than the image of God, we are all in very great trouble. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Caso de Campo in the Dominican Republic, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.